Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1110, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on January 28th of the year 2020. Well, there is an awful lot going on. The next several programs are going to be Miscellaneous Articles and Updates because they are... There is an awful lot going on. A sharp-eyed listener pointed out reading a San Francisco Chronicle article about the alleged suicide of Iris Chang, pointed out that when her body was found after allegedly discharging a Ruger replica of a .45 caliber black powder Army revolver into her mouth, she was found with her hands crossed in her lap and the pistol lying on her left leg. Well, I would not say that is altogether impossible. I will say that is very, very unlikely, and suggests that the crime scene was doctored and or that someone actually fired the fatal shot. That combined with what I suspect was mind control adds another level of alarm or really distress to the loss of Iris Chang. I'll cover that again. Or I should say I will go into that in a future show. I'm also very suspicious of the timing of the coronavirus that is not only destabilizing China, producing something we are told is like the Chinese spring on social media, but it's also roiling capital markets and also causing the drops of stocks that are relevant to Chinese commerce. Someone who knew this was going to happen in advance could perhaps have shorted the stock, not unlike what happened in the assassination of JFK and also September 11th. However, in this country, attention is focused on the impeachment proceedings. They are not focused on what's going on vis-a-vis Deutsche Bank and the Supreme Court, and that is really interesting. But to me, grotesque pantomime going on in Washington is about as, well, disturbing at one level, grotesque at another, and remarkable at yet another. It is, as I've said before, watching the Democrats who have bought in completely on the Russia did it version of the 2016 election, something that just has no firm evidence whatsoever. And the Democrats are in no size, shape, form, or manner examining the overt reconstruction of Nazism in Ukraine to the point where telling the truth about what happened in Ukraine during World War II is a crime thanks to the lustration laws. There is no discussion of that whatsoever. And as Nancy Pelosi, someone I respect in certain ways, she said, it's all about Putin. No, Ms. Pelosi, it's not about Putin at all. What is happening vis-a-vis the U.S. is what has been underway for a long time. And what we are seeing in the impeachment proceedings is what I described as Vichy France, i.e. the Democrats, versus Nazi Germany, i.e. the Republicans, with the New York Times surfacing of John Bolton's forthcoming book. It remains to be seen whether witnesses are called. I wouldn't at this point entirely rule out. I've suspected from the beginning that the Republicans would never vote to convict Donald Trump. I still think that is the greatest possibility. But what we're seeing is basically a psyop, a propaganda vehicle for for ramping up war fever and military spending against Russia. And I think the Ukrainian continuity is what is at stake here. Now that military aid to Ukraine is back on track, I don't think the power structure is really all that concerned. I do think that they're worried that Trump may be a little bit too exculpatory of what they see as the devil Vladimir Putin, and also perhaps the devil Mr. Xi in China. More about China in future broadcasts. But it is quite remarkable to watch what something that has been going on for the better part of 100 years now, in fact, almost exactly 100 years since the end of World War One, something I spoke about in, for the record, 1098, 99, 1100, and 1101. The Intermarium continuity is the central element in those programs, and watching the evolution of the OUN and the OUNB in particular through that period on up through the period between the world wars, through the Promethean League, through the Intermarium Network, through the Third Reich, into the Galen Organization, and through that into the Republican Party, then projected courtesy of the Free Congress Foundation back into Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and now manifesting as the resuscitation of the OUNB fascist or Nazi collaborationist government in Ukraine. There is a picture in a photograph in For the Record, the written description for For the Record 1072 that I'm going to reinsert or insert into the written description for this program as well. It is a picture taken from the summer of 2018 of the official celebration of the anniversary, the 75th anniversary of the founding of the 14th Waffen-SS Division. That picture really says it all, and no one in Washington is questioning whether this is okay. The flavor of the month, Bernie Sanders, and the Bernie bots have bought into the whole Russia did it thing. Bernie Sanders actually delivered one of the Democratic Party's responses to something Trump said, and talked all about how Russia was involved with elevating Trump. Really, that does not surprise me in connection with Bernie Sanders. Not only is he an idiot, but when you look at the people around him, so many of them are either more than likely spooks and tracked to the far right. Perhaps the most important is Jeffrey Sachs. He is not only a member of the Sanders Institute, but perhaps the most important of Bernie Sanders' economic advisors, and now advising Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as well. He and his fellow academicians, I suspect that they were actually CIA academicians from Harvard University, crafted the disastrous oligarch system that grew out of the enlightening privatization of the Soviet economy into the post-Soviet period. Not only did the Russian oligarchs, about which whom we are hearing so much, but the Ukrainian oligarchs, oligarchs in others of the former Soviet republics, are the work of Jeffrey Sachs. The Russians say of him that he was an emissary either of Satan or the CIA. I don't believe in the existence of Satan. I've never seen anything, nor do I think we will see anything concrete that Jeffrey Sachs is in fact CIA. Certainly, the position that he was in and the things that he did are certainly things that is a place the CIA would want someone. They're very good at getting what they want. And the privatization that not only was absolutely disastrous for the Russian and other former Soviet economies, but which led to an awful lot of money flowing into various coffers in the West, courtesy of some of these same oligarchs. Basically, they were Soviet Communist Party apparatchiks. They were bureaucrats in charge of state-run industries. And then lickety-split, they became privatized millionaires or billionaires. Suddenly they were captains of finance and industry in charge of what had been state-administered industries. And they became, or perhaps in some cases already were, corrupt. Certainly with a collapsing system and the widespread disillusion around them, the circumstances were ripe for corruption. That Bernie Sanders, the socialist hero on the horizon, would have as a key economic advisor, or perhaps the most important economic advisor and a member of the Sanders Institute, the man who has probably done more than any other practitioner of neoliberal economics and privatization to wreak economic havoc and widespread and ongoing misery, not only in Russia, but throughout the other former Soviet republics, including, by the way, Ukraine, is remarkable. A lot of people are touting now Bernie Sanders as the front runner. It remains to be seen. But he certainly has a powerful and vicious online presence. And as we looked at in the series about Surveillance Valley, the internet is not only subject to manipulation, but it is itself a weapons system. It is an information weapon, part of an overlapping series of DARPA projects that also created Agent Orange. I mention that because once again we are being told that, yep, those insidious Russians have hacked, not hacked, but they staged a phishing operation at Burisma, the Russian, the Ukrainian, rather, state natural gas institution. Several things to note about this. First of all, this is a New York Times article, and although the New York Times remains the best of America's major dailies, that is a case of damning with faint praise. It is becoming increasingly propagandized, and it has always been the CIA's number one propaganda outlet. They published the Warren Report. There is a very good article by Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame that was published in Rolling Stone about the CIA and the media. It does not predictably go into the profound links between the Washington Post and the CIA, but it does talk about the New York Times. So bear in mind that this is a New York Times story. And note, too, that the security firm that came up with this, quote, information, unquote, had as its co-founder and chief security officer a guy named Blake Darche, D-A-R-C-H-E. He's not only a former NSA operative, but was a principal consultant at CrowdStrike. That is the firm that produced the BS about Russia being behind all of the high-profile hacks, which look like nothing so much as cyber false flag operations. I've gone into that in many shows. Perhaps, time permitting, we'll go into it in this one. But note the overlap in terms of CV between the head of this outfit and CrowdStrike, and in turn, note that chief technology officer and co-founder of CrowdStrike is a member of the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council is financed by, among other institutions, NATO, the State Department, the Baltic States, a key Ukrainian oligarch, and also the Ukrainian World Congress, which is a manifestation in large measure of the OUN and OUNB in particular. The Atlantic Council has been a major vehicle banging the war drums against Russia and on behalf of the OUNB elements in control of the Ukrainian National Security Establishment Police and their education department. And it is more than a little interesting to see Mr. Barchet having a intersection with CrowdStrike. I will also note that we are being told again that this is the GRU and that they've gotten very, very lazy. There is no hard evidence whatsoever that the hacks that initially took place of the German Bundestag, APT-28 and APT-29, that there's any link between them and Russia, except that is what the German news media said. The, quote, hack, unquote, into Hillary Clinton's email used an outdated PAS shell designed by a Ukrainian hacker named Professor, who is under the control of the OUNB elements in Ukraine. Anton Garoshenko, a member of the Ukrainian parliament, very close to Pravi Sektor, Svoboda, and the OUNB successor organizations in power in Ukraine, is in charge of Professor, who used an outdated PAS shell and hard-coded his IP address into the, or at least whoever did the hack, used an outdated PAS shell and hard-coded their IP address into the malware. It is just ludicrous. No hacker worth his, her, or their salt is going to do that unless it is meant to be a cyber false flag operation. The hack into Mr. Podesta's email used an open Bitly account, which just happened to permit anyone in the world to follow everything that was going on in real time. That, too, is ludicrous, not only obvious, but clumsy cyber false flag operation. Cyber affairs are such that a good false flag operation can be done by a skilled operator, and the Russians are very good at doing that. The remarkably clumsy the attacks done by the Boris and Natasha group into the NSA cyber tools was perhaps even more ludicrous. That, too, appears to have been a download of the relevant material. One of the suspects is Jacob Applebaum, who is financed by the Broadcasting Board of Governors, a CIA derivative associated with Julian Assange. And that particular grotesque cyber false flag operation was accompanied by this broken Russian Boris and Natasha type trapper. Again, a very crude effort. There were also hacks allegedly by Russia into the Macron campaign, but the chief of cybersecurity in France said that no such thing took place, and some of the downloaded material eventually was traced to Andrew Auerheimer, a.k.a. Weave, an apparently Ukrainian-based hacker who is the web architect for the Daily Stormer and also has links to Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. However, none of this is going to stop our media, which at this point are just wholly propagandized. Note that phishing attacks can be done by almost anyone. Again, that's P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G. And we're being told that Russian hackers are incredibly lazy, and that's why they just keep making the same stupid mistakes over and over and over. And we're also told that pattern recognition is very much in effect here. So, again, note those following considerations. We're going to come back to Burisma in our next story, and we're going to see that not only is the Atlantic Council a recipient of Burisma financing, but that on the board of Burisma, along with Hunter Biden, is a guy named Kofor Black, a quote ex-unquote CIA guy, who also was the vice president of Blackwater, Eric Prince's organization, and also Mr. Kwasniewski, a former prime minister of Poland, who was one of the point people in Paul Manafort's Habsburg group attempting to ease Ukraine from the Russian into the Western orbit, which raises some interesting questions about the fishing event allegedly perpetrated by Russia. Note that with people like Mr. Kwasniewski, with people like Kofor Black, and with the Atlantic Council being a recipient of Burisma funds, there would be plenty of opportunity for right-wing and anti-Russian malefactors to come up with email addresses that could then be attributed to this phishing event. With that, and the entire article will be in the written description for this show, from the New York Times of January 13th of 2020, Russians hacked Ukrainian gas company at center of impeachment. This is by Nicole Perlroth, P-E-R-L-R-O-T-H, and Matthew Rosenberg of the New York Times. With President Trump facing an impeachment trial over his efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Joseph R. Biden Jr. and his son Hunter Biden, Russian military hackers have been boring into the Ukrainian gas company at the center of the affair, according to security experts. The hacking attempts against Burisma, the Ukrainian gas company on whose board Hunter Biden served, began in early November as talk of the Biden's Ukraine and impeachment was dominating the news in the U.S. The Russian tactics are strikingly similar to what American intelligence agencies say was Russia's hacking of emails from Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman and the Democratic National Committee during the 2016 presidential campaign. In that case, once they had the emails, the Russians used trolls to spread and spin the material and built an echo chamber to widen its effect. I would note in that regard the much ballyhooed Facebook posts from Russia. There were anywhere between 50 and 80,000 Russian origin, Facebook posts of Russian origin. It has never been established that those came from the Russian government. There's also a vigorous fascist community in Russia, by the way. But now those, depending on what source one uses, those 50 to 80,000 Facebook posts are out of a total of 33 trillion Facebook posts in the same time. I aired when I said that was somewhere between 15 and 20 millionths of 1% of the Facebook posts. I forgot the set of zeros. That would be between 15 and 20 100 millionths of 1% of Facebook posts in that period. And they then would have been directed in all probability by the Cambridge Analytica folks to people that were deemed receptive. Returning to the New York Times article, then as 2016, then as now, the Russian hackers from a military intelligence unit formerly known as the GRU and the private researchers by the alias Fancy Bear used so-called phishing emails that appeared designed to steal usernames and passwords, according to Area 1, the Silicon Valley security firm that detected the hacking. And again, note that the founder of this was formerly a consultant to the Atlantic Council, skipping down. Area 1 researchers discovered a GRU phishing campaign on Ukrainian companies on New Year's Eve. A week later, Area 1 determined that the Ukrainian targets determined what the Ukrainian targets had in common. They were all subsidiaries of Burisma Holdings, the company at the center of Mr. Trump's impeachment. Among the Burisma subsidiaries fished were KUB Gas Albea, Esko Pidnich, Nagrogas, Petrocom, Service, and Pari. These targets also included Kvartal 95, a Ukrainian television company founded by Mr. Zelensky, that he is the president of Ukraine. The fishing attack on Kvartal 95 appears to have been aimed at digging up email correspondence for the company's chief, Ivan Bakanov, who Mr. Zelensky appointed as the head of Ukraine's security service last June. To steal employees' credentials, the GRU hackers directed Burisma to their fake login pages. Area 1 was able to trace the lookalike sites through a combination of internet service providers frequently used by GRU's hackers, rare web traffic patterns, and techniques that have been used in previous attacks against a slew of other victims, including the 2016 hack of the DNC and a more recent Russian hack of the World Doping Agency. The Burisma hack is a cookie-cutter GRU campaign, or Mr. Oren Falkowitz said. He's the head of Area 1. Russian hackers, as sophisticated as they are, also tend to be lazy. They use what works, and in this case, they were successful. Something to keep in mind also is that Obama sanctioned the placing of cyber weaponry on Russian computer networks. So what role that may have played in some of this is an open question. I wonder about the Iranian downing of a Ukrainian plane with a Russian anti-aircraft missile system. Could that have played a role there? And also, something very important has to be kept in mind. This is from the Heavy Blog of April 3rd of 2017. WikiLeaks Vault 7 Part 3 reveals CIA tool might mask hacks as Russian, Chinese, or Arabic. This by Stephanie Dube or Dube, D-U-B-E, Dwilson, D-W-I-L-S-O-N. Again, note that the CIA's cyber weaponry can mimic Russian, Chinese, Korean, Arabic, or Farsi. Therefore, one should not automatically conclude that if there is a hack by one of those elements, but it certainly will make CIA a suspect in anything they allegedly did. It would be impossible to exaggerate the extent to which the CIA it doesn't interfere in American politics. It governs American politics. In fact, I've come to feel over the decades that the country is pretty much run by the CIA. There's four, the corporations and also the military. But I think when necessary, the CIA games the military, and I suspect MSA as well. I think one level of the Snowden op was the CIA being in a position to blackmail MSA over the upcoming Russiagate war propaganda psyop. If NSA analysts or any individual analyst said, nah, this is a bunch of crap, then they would be in the position to blackmail NSA and release NSA's most secure information. But note the following again from the Heavy Blog of April 3rd of 2017. WikiLeaks Vault 7 Part 3 reveals CIA tool might mask hacks as Russian, Chinese, or Arabic. This morning, WikiLeaks released Part 3 of its Vault 7 series called Marble. Marble, again, like the round toy, M-A-R-B-L-E, reveals CIA source code files along with decoy languages that might disguise viruses, trojans, and hacking attacks. These tools could make it more difficult for antivirus companies and forensic investigators to attribute hacks to the CIA. Could this call the source of previous hacks into question? It appears that, yes, this might be used to disguise the CIA's own hacks to appear as if they were Russian, Chinese, or from specific other countries. These tools were in use in 2016, WikiLeaks reported. It is not known exactly how this marble tool was actually used. However, according to WikiLeaks, the tool could make it more difficult for investigators and antivirus companies to attribute viruses and other hacking tools to the CIA. Test examples weren't just in English, but also Russian, Chinese, Korean, Arabic, and Farsi. This might allow a malware creator to not only look like they were speaking in Russian or Chinese rather than in English, but to also look like they tried to hide that they were not speaking English, according to WikiLeaks. This might also hide fake error messages or to be used for other purposes. So again, who exactly was that? One of the assumptions that our political and journalist establishment make is that the Russians are absolute idiots, as are the Chinese. And Russia is a country where chess is a national passion. And in China, their intelligence services glow up reading Sun Tzu and The Art of War. In this country, people grow up looking at pictures of Kim Kardashian's rear end on the internet. And it's just some the depth and degeneracy of American online culture is startling to me. There is a book called It Came From Something Awful that I would recommend. I'm going to interview the author, time permitting, in the future. it is really remarkable to watch in this country how everyone else is assumed by the American political leadership, the journalistic establishment, and, of course, our intelligence services, I think, are actually creating a lot of this. It is assumed that they're idiots, when, in fact, the American people are idiots.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, again, back to Burisma, the Ukrainian natural gas company on whose board Hunter Biden sat, and that was the focal point of this alleged Russian fishing expedition. Now, note that also on the board of Burisma were Mr. Krasniewski, former Polish prime minister, who was a key member of Paul Manafort's Habsburg group, spoken about in For the Record program numbers 1007, 1008, and 1009, as well as in a big way 1022, that was involved in setting up the Maidan coup. They were attempting to lure Ukraine from the Russian into the Western orbit. When that failed, they had the Maidan coup. But Mr. Krasniewski was part of the Habsburg group working with Paul Manafort, another appointee to the board of directors with Hunter Biden and Mr. Krasniewski, was Kofor Black, an ex-CIA officer, that's always a very questionable appellation, who was the number two guy in the Blackwater security outfit run by Eric Prince, the Machiavellian genius, who is also the sister of Betsy DeVos, Donald Trump's Secretary of Education. Note that another business partner of Eric Prince is one of the directors of Emerdata, the revised Cambridge Analytica firm, and this guy is a Hong Kong-based basically an oligarch, multi-millionaire, actually I think a billionaire. So note here again that Mr. Krasniewski, I think his name was Michael, or maybe Alexander Krasniewski, Michael Manafort's associate in the Hotspur Group, is also a director of Burisma. Note that Kofor Black, ex-CIA, and the former number two guy in Eric Prince's Blackwater security firm, is also on the board. And note again that, again, Burisma is a contributor. It basically has a partnership with the Atlantic Council. So the Atlantic Council and Kofor Black and Mr. Krasniewski will all be in the position to plumb the depths of Burisma. And if, in fact, Mr. Krasniewski, or if in fact, email addresses do turn up, that will certainly be something they could provide the CIA with. They then could ape Russian interference. From the Financial Times of September 29th of 2019, Ukraine gas company feels heat of U.S. impeachment probe by Roman Olearchyk, O-L-E-A-R-C-H-Y-K, and Max Sedin, S-E-B-B-O-N. When Ukraine's kleptocratic elite fled to Russia after a pro-Western revolution in 2014, former Minister Mykola Zlochevsky, Z-L-O-C-H-E-V-S-K-Y, suddenly found himself the target of an international investigation into the source of his wealth. Skipping down. Mr. Zlochevsky, the owner of Burisma, Ukraine's largest private gas company, which acquired several of its extraction licenses while he was in government, had lost a political patron when Mr. Yanukovych was evicted from office. Weeks later, the energy tycoon sought help elsewhere. Burisma made a surprise appointment to its board, Hunter Biden, younger son of the then U.S. Vice President Joe Biden. It was a move that would ultimately lead to the impeachment proceedings triggered last week against President Donald Trump. Mr. Biden's five-year tenure on Burisma's board, which ended this year as his father announced his run for president, was part of a shrewd campaign by Mr. Zlochevsky to repair his image in the West. And skipping down. I'm talking about Joe Biden pushing Ukraine to investigate corruption. And the push left, and Biden, Joe Biden, that is, was pushing Ukraine to investigate corruption. The push left Mr. Biden in the bizarre position of pushing Ukraine to investigate a company where his son worked at the time. In 2015, then U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt publicly accused Mr. Shokin of deliberately tripping up the U.K. proceedings by telling Mr. Zlochevsky's lawyers that there was no evidence of his wrongdoing. Mr. Shokin, a now ousted Ukrainian chief prosecutor. Skipping down. As well as the younger Mr. Biden, who said he hoped to improve Burisma's transparency, unquote, corporate governance and responsibility, they, the other directors, included former Polish President Alexander Kwasniewski, that's K-W-A-S-N-I-E-W-S-K-I, who had visited Ukraine dozens of times as an EU envoy, and Devin Archer, Mr. Biden's longtime business partner. Burisma paid Mr. Biden $50,000 a month, according to the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Kwasniewski, again, who was the point guy from the EU trying to move Ukraine from the Russian into the Western orbit and working, a key member of the Hotspur Group working with Paul Manafort. Burisma paid Mr. Biden $50,000 a month, according to the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Kwasniewski remains a board member of Burisma, according to Burisma's website, alongside former investment banker Alan Apter, A-P-T-E-R, and ex-Blackwater director Kofor Black. Excuse me, I thought he was the number two guy, but ex-Blackwater director Kofor Black. So the former director of Blackwater is now on the board of Burisma and has been there, along with Mr. Kwasniewski, the EU envoy, attempting to work out the agreement to have Ukraine become part of the EU, and working with the Habsburg Group and Paul Manafort. Skipping down. In 2017, Burisma announced that it faced no active prosecution cases, then formed a partnership with the Atlantic Council, a U.S. think tank active in promoting anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine. Burisma donated between $100,000 and $250,000 to the Atlantic Council last year, according to its annual report, and sent executives to speak alongside the think tank's experts at several conferences. So again, the Atlantic Council is now partnered with Burisma. The Atlantic Council also has huge links to the aforementioned CrowdStrike, and also an evidentiary tributary running in the direction of the Area 1 cybersecurity firm. And I erred when I said Kofor Black was the number two guy at Blackwater. He was the ex-director of Blackwater and, quote, ex-unquote, CIA. So as we hear that, yep, the Russians have hacked or have conducted a phishing operation vis-a-vis Burisma, The Russians don't need to fish Burisma. I mean, there are so many malefactors involved with Burisma, and any dirt that they may want to come up with on Hunter Biden, you've got people like Mr. Kwasniewski, and you've got people like Kofor Black on the board of directors, and you've also got the Atlantic Council partnered with the aforementioned Burisma. The Atlantic Council heavily linked, again, financed by NATO, the State Department, the Baltic States, the Ukrainian World Congress, an outgrowth of the OUN, and also a Ukrainian oligarch as well.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
The alleged interference by Russia in American elections, aside from the ludicrous nature of the evidence, should be seen against the background of a documented history of American interference in Russia's elections. By the way, I'm not sure, actually. Certainly, Jeffrey Sachs sent Russia back to the Stone Age. He may not have had a chance to privatize all of the republics of the former Soviet Union. That may have happened after Boris Yeltsin dissolved the Soviet Union. But for some perspective, from Consortium News of April 26th of 2018 by Ted Snyder, S-N-I-B-E-R, accusing Russia and listening to history. Skipping down. In late 1991, after the fall of the Soviet Union, Boris Yeltsin won a year of special powers from the Russian parliament. For 1 year, he was to be, in effect, the dictator of Russia to facilitate the midwifery of the birth of a democratic Russia. In March of 1992, under pressure from a discontented population, parliament repealed the dictatorial powers it had granted him. Yeltsin responded by declaring a state of emergency, giving himself the repealed dictatorial powers. Russia's Constitutional Court ruled that Yeltsin was acting outside the Constitution, but the U.S. sided against the Russian people and against the Russian Constitutional Court and with Yeltsin. Intoxicated with American support, and I would add no shortage of vodka, Yeltsin dissolved the parliament that had rescinded his powers and abolished the Constitution, of which he was in violation. in a 636-2 vote. The Russian parliament impeached Boris Yeltsin. One more time. In a 636-2 vote, the Russian parliament impeached Yeltsin. But President Bill Clinton again sided with Yeltsin against the Russian people and Russian law, giving him $2.5 billion in aid. Clinton was interfering in the Russian people's choice of leaders. Yeltsin took the money and sent police officers and elite paratroopers to surround the parliament building. Clinton, quote, praised the Russian president as sick, having done quite well in managing the standoff with the Russian parliament, unquote, as the New York Times reported at the time. Clinton added that he thought, quote, the United States and the free world ought to hang in there, unquote, with their support of Yeltsin against its people, their constitution, and their courts, and Judge Yeltsin to be, quote, on the right side of history. Bear in mind that top Sanders and AOC economic advisor Jeffrey Sachs was the person in charge of Yeltsin's reorganization of the Russian economy that sent Russia back to the Stone Age and resulted in the oligarchs that we are seeing manifested today. Continuing. On the right side of history and armed with machine guns, Yeltsin's troops opened fire on the crowd of protesters, killing about 100 people before setting the Russian parliament building on fire. By the time the day was over, Yeltsin's troops had killed an unconfirmed 500 people and wounded nearly 1,000. Still, Clinton stood with Yeltsin. He provided ludicrous cover for Yeltsin's massacre, claiming that, quote, I don't see that he had any choice. If such a thing happened in the U.S., you would have expected me to take tough action against it. Clinton's Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, said that the U.S. supported Yeltsin's suspension of parliament in these, quote, extraordinary times, unquote. In 1996, America would interfere yet again. With elections looming, Yeltsin's popularity was non-existent, and his approval rating was at about 6%. According to Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies at Princeton University, Stephen Cohen, Clinton's interference in Russian politics, his, quote, crusade, unquote, to, quote, reform Russia, unquote, had now become official policy. And so America boldly interfered directly in Russian elections. Three American political consultants receiving direct assistance from Bill Clinton's White House, unquote, secretly ran Yeltsin's re-election campaign. As Time magazine broke the story, for 4 months, a group of American political consultants clandestinely participated in guiding Yeltsin's campaign, unquote. Funded by the U.S. government, unquote, Cohen reports, Americans, quote, gave money to favored Russian politicians, instructed ministers, drafted legislation and presidential decrees, underwrote textbooks, and served at Yeltsin's re-election headquarters in 1996. More incriminating is that Richard Dresner, capital D-R-E-S-N-E-R, one of the three American consultants, maintained a direct line to Clinton's chief strategist, Dick Morris. According to reporting by Sean Guillory in his book Behind the Oval Office, Morris says that with Clinton's approval, he received weekly briefings from Dresner that he would give to Clinton. Based on those briefings, Clinton would then provide recommendations to Dresner through Morris. Then Ambassador to Russia Thomas Pickering even pressured an opposing candidate to drop out of the election to improve Yeltsin's odds of winning. The U.S. not only helped run Yeltsin's campaign, they helped pay for it. The U.S. backed a $10.2 billion International Monetary Fund loan for Russia, the second biggest loan the IMF had ever given. The New York Times reported that the loan, quote, was expected to be helpful to President Boris M. Yeltsin in the presidential election in June. The Times explained that the loan was a, quote, vote of confidence, unquote, for Yeltsin, who, quote, has been lagging well behind in opinion polls, unquote, and added that the U.S. Treasury Secretary, quote, welcomed the fund's decision. Yeltsin won the election by 13%, and Time magazine's cover declared, quote, Yanks to the rescue, the secret story of how American advisors helped Yeltsin win. Cohen reports that the U.S. ambassador to Russia boasted that, quote, without our leadership, we would see a considerably different Russia today, unquote. That is a confession of election interference. 15 years later, Russia would accuse America of meddling still when protests broke out over flawed parliamentary elections in December of 2011. Putin said that Hillary Clinton, quote, set the tone for some actors in our country and gave them a signal, unquote. He accused the State Department of supporting the protesters. The accusation could be dismissed if the State Department hadn't declared its intention to, quote, establish a direct relationship with the Russian people over the Kremlin's head. As recently as 2000, Putin was still answering the question of whether Russia would join NATO with, quote, why not, unquote. He saw Russia as part of a transformed community where Russia was, quote, part of European culture, part of the civilized world, unquote, where, quote, seeing NATO as an enemy is destructive for Russia, unquote. Sakwa says that in the early 2000s, Putin seriously entered into informal talks about NATO membership until the U.S. vetoed the idea. Sakwa says that Putin continued to engage the West and to attempt to forge a post-Cold War partnership. Immediately after 9/11, Putin offered America logistical and intelligence support and helped take out the Taliban. Sakwa quoted an American official who rated Russian support after 9/11 as, quote, as important as that of any NATO ally, unquote. Rather than picking the hand Russia was offering in partnership, America slapped it by pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty and announcing that it would now welcome the Baltic states into NATO. Despite Russian attempts to integrate Europe and the international community into a world order that transcended Cold War divisions, pacts, and rivalries, Europe and the West continued to maintain and expand those divisions. 2008 saw the creation of the Eastern Partnership, or EAP. Sakwa explains that the aim of the EAP was to draw Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia into the Western sphere. So again, this is overt interference into the Russian election, obviously. And beyond that, there has been actual covert action inside of Russia vis-a-vis the Caucasus, the Bank Alpakhla, which was at the focal point of the Operation Green Quest attenuated investigation, that attenuated by then head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, that very special prosecutor who was in charge of the Russiagate, quote, investigation, unquote, and basically suppressed information involving two dual overlapping covert operations. One, the operation headed by Mr. Manafort and the Hotspur Group and Mr. Kwasniewski to move Ukraine into the Western orbit as opposed to Russian. That was opened in the Maidan coup. And also the attempts by the Trump real estate interests to penetrate Russia and to set up a Trump tower in Moscow. And the individual in charge of, that was heavily involved with the Operation Green Quest investigations and a longtime CIA asset. I will also note that in connection with things like the Boston Marathon bombing, the Tsarnaev brothers, Russia warned the U.S. about the Tsarnaev brothers and that they were linked to terrorists. Their uncle, Uncle Ruslan, was the spokesperson for the bombers. He was the former son-in-law of Graham Fuller, the former station chief in Afghanistan, and someone who was, actually, it may have been Pakistan, but it was, I think it was Afghanistan, I will double-check that, but Graham Fuller was a major figure involved with the operation that lured the Russians, or the Soviets at that time, into Afghanistan. He and Uncle Ruslan, that is to say Graham Fuller, formed an organization called Chechen International. Something I did not mention, that we have spoken about the fact that a large part, almost half, maybe more than half, of the federal dossiers on the Tsarnaev brothers were blacked out when they were released to the public. Tamerlane Tsarnaev was married to a woman named Catherine Russell. She was from an old, prominent Yale family that set up the Russell Trust. The Russell Trust eventually morphed into Skull and Bones. So basically, Tamerlane Tsarnaev married to a member of the family that set up what was to become Skull and Bones. Again, tremendous interference in Russia and the Bank Al-Taqwa, as we looked at in various programs, including For the Record 381, deeply involved with actions in the Caucasus. Also the UNA, UNSO, one of the iterations of the UPA, the military wing of the OUNB, was active in the Georgian War. That was the Georgian War that involved Russia and Georgia. That same group was also involved, the UNA, UNSO, a manifestation of the UPA, was also involved in shoring up Boris Yeltsin as well. And again, bear in mind the guy who was in charge of the disastrous economic policies put in place by Boris Yeltsin was none other than Jeffrey Sachs, a member of the Sanders Institute and arguably the most important economic advisor to not only Bernie Sanders, but also Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. As we contemplate the impeachment proceedings, bear in mind that Boris Yeltsin dissolved Parliament and ultimately used troops to kill anywhere from somewhere between 100 and 500 people and wounding 1,000. And note that in a 636-2 vote, the Russian Parliament impeached Yeltsin. We then supported Yeltsin when he used armed troops to put down Parliament. So, history is very interesting indeed. We will continue with our analyses of many different things because there has been an awful lot going on in Iran, in Iraq, in China, and elsewhere. This, however, concludes For the Record program number 1110, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on January 28th of 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.